So just so you don't caught by surprise.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Today is Wednesday, February 22nd, 2017. I'm opening a meeting of the Joint Committee on Ways and Means Subcommittee on Human Services. And today we will be opening a public hearing on House Bill 5026, the Oregon Health Authority, Oregon State Hospital. Or maybe I never did need to open it, so we never closed it. Ms. Ames.
Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee, I did just want to let you know that the state hospital has a great but fairly long presentation, and we do need to finish it up today. Since there's some really good stuff at the end.
Is that a hint?
It's up to the chair.
Yeah.
Good morning. I'm Greg Roberts. I am the superintendent of the Oregon State Hospital, and I think that was more a hint to me than to
you. Nice. Good morning. My name is John Swanson. I'm the chief financial and operating officer for the Oregon State Hospital.
Good morning. Tom McDonald with the DAS chief financial office.
The floor is yours, superintendent.
Okay. Thank you. I'll look to go quickly through certain slides. Certainly, if you have questions, we can answer them, but I think certain slides are going to be more robust for discussion than some others. So one thing that we always like to do when we make this presentation is to talk a little bit about the recent history of the hospital. I'm sure most members of the committee are aware that less than 10 years ago, or about 10 years ago now, in 2006, the United States Department of Justice visited Oregon State Hospital, evaluated the hospital's compliance with civil rights legislation related to institutionalized persons, issued some very negative reports about the hospital, and so the journey began with the legislature's decision to build new facilities in Salem and in Junction City and to add services to the hospital so that we could provide the type of care and treatment in a safe environment that we aim to for our patients. So we include the vision statement and the mission statement for that reason, because the very often organizations have a mission statement, it may be posted on or signed in the lobby, and few people think about it or take it seriously. But I can assure you that at Oregon State Hospital, we focus on this mission all the time. There are very few state hospital employees who wouldn't be able to tell you this mission if we asked them right now to tell us. So it got us focused on why we're here, what we do, and what we're expected to do. And to tell you something that some of you I know have already heard, we believe very strongly that in the last 10 years, Oregon State Hospital has moved from being one of the worst state hospitals in the United States, worst performing, to the best. Best performing state hospital in the country. And that's been reinforced to us by the Joint Commission on Accreditation of Hospitals and by about 20 other states who have come to Oregon and visited our hospital and are just floored. Just can't believe that a state hospital could possibly look like ours looks and operates like ours. So it's a real achievement. Who we are, slide just talks about the intensity of services that we provide. Obviously, we're on the end of the spectrum of services for people, the most intense services, and obviously the most costly. You can go to the next one. This is the org chart, just giving you a sense of, I report directly to the Oregon Health Authority Director, Lynn Saxton, and these are most but not all of my direct reports. You'll note, and we'll talk about this later in the presentation, the Pendleton cottages have been added to my responsibilities. This is an SRTF way out in Pendleton that once certain services closed in Eastern Oregon, there was a question as to where the cottages should report, and they have been assigned to me. And that has,
I'm sorry to interrupt you. We're working hard because we've got a lot of new members to avoid acronyms or at least explain them the first time. Can you remind
secure
us about
thank you. Secure residential facility. For guilty except for insanity patients who are leaving the hospital, and it's their first step down into a less restrictive setting. Thank you. who we serve. We have basically four categories of patients that we serve. People who are guilty except for insanity. These are people who have been adjudicated through the system. They have been basically successfully applied the insanity defense. Some have committed major crimes, tier one offenses. Those people are under the jurisdiction of the Psychiatric Security Board when they're in the community and when they're in the hospital. And then people with lower level crimes, non-Measure 11 crimes, are under the jurisdiction of the State Hospital Review Panel, which parallels the Psychiatric Security Review Board in terms of membership and how it operates. But then Tier 2, non-Measure 11 patients, when they are released to the community, they go back under the jurisdiction of the Psychiatric Security Review Board. We have people who are involuntarily civilly committed. These are people who meet the criteria for civil commitment, which is a primary diagnosis of mental illness and imminently dangerous to themselves or other people, or who are gravely disabled, people who are not able to take care of their basic life needs because of their mental illness. Then we have the aid and assist population, generally referred to as the 370 patients. That's just the last three digits of the statute that applies. And these are people who are arrested in the community for either felonies or misdemeanors and who are evaluated as being unable to aid and assist their attorney to mount a defense against their charges or even to understand the legal system. And the responsibility of the state hospital for 370 patients is to restore them to competency, to restore them to the ability to aid and assist their attorney so then they can proceed through the legal system, or to evaluate the person after a period of treatment as being never able to aid and assist their attorney. And then even those patients are returned to the judicial system for proceeding. And then last is the neuropsychiatric services, which I know some of us have had this discussion, generally referred to as the geriatric population of the hospital. But the fact is that less than half of those patients are over the age of 65 at this point. Half are, but others in that area of the hospital are people with traumatic brain injury, dementia, and or co-occurring serious medical issues. So this slide will probably deserve discussion. This gives the summary for 2016 calendar year in terms of the different categories of patients, our average daily population, and total admits and length of stay. So what's noteworthy on this page is the 370 aid and assist population. Average population 218, which is significantly increased for us from past years, and very noticeably 62% of all admissions to the state hospital are coming to the state hospital in this category under this statute that allows people to be sent to the state hospital. So this, I think, will be a topic we'll be discussing. But the guilty except for insanity population is low, actually historically low, down by nearly 100, decreased by nearly 100 in the last 5 years, so, but with more opportunities in the community for secure residential facilities and other services where people can live in the community under the jurisdiction of the Psychiatric Security Review Board. The civil population has been relatively flat for the past 5 years. The aid and assist population has increased significantly. So, any questions? Okay.
I'm sorry. Sorry.
Thank you, co-chairs. Just a couple of quick questions. One, the slide under the departments, the five departments that you oversee, Superintendent Roberts, I noticed that three of those are interim positions. How long have they been interim, and are we moving towards getting those permanent positions?
Senator Steiner Hayward, Representative Hayden, members of the committee. The reason for that has everything to do with my upcoming retirement retiring at the end of March, as you know. And the positions, we thought it would not be prudent to appoint for me to select people for the position. The positions became vacant through a variety of means, and being close, we think, to selecting a new superintendent, we thought that we would allow the next superintendent to fill those positions on a permanent basis, either with these staff or with others.
But follow-up to that, just comment, thank you. I think you've done a fantastic job over the time that you've been here, so maybe it would be appropriate for you to fill those positions. You've obviously put together an excellent team, and I appreciate that a lot. So I guess that's policy-driven. But
thank you. Actually, since the search for the next superintendent has taken longer than we anticipated, that actually may become a possibility at this point. Okay. So the next few slides are ones I think we can quickly go past. This is, again, just a reminder where the hospital was not that long ago with the idea of how far we've come. And the timeline on this slide as well just reminds us that several facilities have closed in the past few years. Blue Mountain Recovery Center was a 60-bed facility out in Pendleton. That was closed. Our 72-bed Portland campus closed in 2015. And basically, that number of beds became the number of beds in Junction City. 132. Portland was actually originally 92 beds, so 152 beds became 174 beds in Junction City. two facilities closed, one opened. So the next slide talks about the performance system, which again I'll go quickly over. Many times I'm asked, and I do appreciate the positive comments, that the transformation of the hospital as it's occurred and has been recognized. This is basically how periodically people will come to the hospital and say, how did you do this? We did this by actually focusing on problem solving, and we use lean methodology as our process for identifying problems, collecting data, make sure we understand the problem correctly, assign people who are most closely associated with that issue to ask them to make improvements. So they basically identify the current state of the process, what we need the future state to become, and then we move from the current state to the future state. And when you do that every day for 6 years, you make a lot of positive improvements. So it's called a performance system.
Superintendent, one of the challenges I think most organizations face when going through major transformation is change fatigue. Could you, at some point, if it's appropriate, talk a little bit about how you've managed that? Because I think it would be a useful lesson for other agencies that are undergoing major transformation.
Senator Steiner, Hayward, and members of the committee, I'm happy to do that right now. We absolutely experienced several periods of change fatigue. Back to 2011, when we were moving the old hospital across the street to the new hospital, we did that incrementally. So it was, in a way, peeling a Band-Aid off very slowly. So certain patients moved, then construction proceeded, then more patients moved. It took a year and a half at least to do that. Then we were planning for the closure of Blue Mountain and absorbing that patient population into Salem. And shortly after that, we opened Junction City, and at the same time, closed Portland. So all of the changes there, not just patient transfers, but changes in processes, retraining of staff in different policies, procedures, while also implementing lean methodology and focusing on other issues that needed to be addressed at the hospital. It was clear on several occasions that people were feeling overwhelmed, and we made conscious decisions about reprioritizing several things and focusing on the things that absolutely had to be focused on. So what's interesting about that, one of the reports, the Liberty Healthcare report that's cited in one of the timelines, is kind of an infamous report from 2010 that has a famous quote in it from our point of view, that in its zeal to fix everything in a four-year period, the hospital hadn't fixed anything. They had simply taken on too many things. So one of our conscious reminders was to make sure that we don't take on too much. When I arrived in the hospital in 2010, it was clear people think conditions at the hospital had been seriously problematic for a long period of time, and people had begun to feel hopeless and helpless. And leaders of the organization would express to me that they weren't sure these problems could be fixed. And so we had to focus there. So we've come from being hopeless and helpless to trying to make sure we don't put too much on our plates and we only focus on the things. There's 100 things we can fix, but we can't fix 100 things at once. So we have a system of prioritizing the things we're looking at.
Well done. Representative Alonso Vail and Representative Bueller.
Thank you for sharing this, your informed decision making. I really appreciate the second bullet, staff closest to the problem, propose the solutions. Doing value-based management, I think, is really critical because oftentimes the people who are doing the work know what the challenges are and oftentimes know how to solve it, but they need the opportunity to be heard. So I appreciate that was part of the work in transforming, because when that happens, then there's a lot more buy-in into the transition, and sure, people want to stay and work because their perspective is valued. So thank you for that.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. Superintendent Roberts, great job. I mean, I just hear nothing but positive remarks about your time at the hospital. I just was curious in your retirement if you would be willing to act as a consultant to the legislature in lean process.
Senator Steiner, Hayward, Representative Bueller, absolutely. Although I wouldn't regard myself as the expert. We have 10 staff in our performance improvement department who are well trained in lean methodology. I think my contribution comes from I overuse the example of being an orchestra leader. So if you envision the various parts of the organization as sections of an orchestra, I'm just conducting the orchestra. So I know enough about lean to sort of insist sometimes on what we're doing or to control the process of setting priorities and things like that. So, but yes, sure. Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah. And you may not be able to answer this, but do you have a sense of how many other departments or agencies throughout state government have that kind of approach and dedication to lean process improvement?
Senator Steiner Hayward, Representative Bueller, and members of the committee. It's my understanding several departments of the state are using lean methodology. Department of Transportation, I think Veterans Affairs, some others we've heard are using it pretty successfully. So, and to respond to Representative Alonzo Hayward, that's the heart of the process. This is based on the Toyota model that we learned from some consultants that we engaged, that the people in Toyota years ago, people in the boardroom, they were having difficulty selling cars. People in the boardroom finally realized maybe we should ask the people on the assembly line. Yep. And they engaged people on the assembly line in the problem-solving process, and things moved on from there. So it's just a reminder that people in the executive suite people in the executive suite don't know the problem well enough. People closest to the problem do, and you have to engage them in the identification of the problem and in the solution. And then when people are engaged in that process, they really get turned on. And again, that's when then the other problem comes up, that now you have 100 things. People want to raise their hand and say, let's look at this, let's look at this. But you can't look at everything all at once. So that was supposed to be a quick slide. Where we are now?
We're good.
Overhead map of Salem, quick. Then facts and figures about our Salem campus. We have a capacity of 24 units and 6 cottages. We're operating all 24 units. That's a change from the last biennium when we were here, mainly because of the 370 population growth. And we no longer operate the cottages, which were licensed as residential treatment facilities, actually even less restrictive than a secure residential facility in the community. And where there was a time in history when state hospitals had good reason to operate such programs, transitional programs on the property, that no longer exists. So our patients, when our patients are ready for discharge or community placement, they go to the community. They don't need the type of services that the cottages historically provided. Our average census is about 535, and I have our capacity here somewhere. Position authority, and this refers to the governor's budget, the recommendation that includes a POP that is coming up also in the slides that we can talk about. But for the 15-17 biennium, we had position authority in Salem for 1,872 staff, and the governor's budget for the next upcoming biennium is $485.4 million for Salem, and then Junction City we'll talk about separately.
This is just Salem.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And the next slide is the overview of Junction City campus, which opened coming up on 2 years at this point. The capacity there is 6 units and 3 cottages, and we're operating 4 units and none of the cottages at this time. The average census there has been 78, slightly higher recently because of the growth of the 370 population, the aid and assist population in Salem. We needed to open a 4th unit in Junction City, which is operating at about half capacity at this point. So the average census has been slightly higher more recently than 78. So it's about 81, 82 more recently. Position authority for the Junction City campus in the governor's budget is 357, which is the same as the current biennium. And the governor's budget for 2017-19 recommends $41.5 million for Junction City, assuming a closure of that facility in July of 2018. Then Pendleton Cottage, as I mentioned, in the last year and a half, Pendleton Cottage was assigned to my supervision. It's not part of Oregon State Hospital. It's separately. It's just that Pendleton Cottages and Oregon State Hospital have a common supervisor. But it's we don't regard Pendleton Cottage as being part of the state hospital system. It's a secure residential facility, 16 beds. Their beds are always filled. They have 42 staff approved for hire. And the governor's budget for the next biennium there is $9 million. Next. Patient population trends. The first slide is the total census. And this, to have apples compared to apples, we took into account these numbers reflect the beds that were open at the time. So further back in history, this is Pendleton, the Blue Mountain Recovery Center, Portland, and Salem. Later on, the numbers represent Salem and Junction City. But so you can see it's relatively flat, the census of the state hospital for the 5-year period. What's interesting about that is if you then look, the next slide is the population trend for the guilty except for insanity patients. We're down by nearly 100 guilty except for insanity patients at the state hospital in the 5-year period. And this reflects, I would say, reflects the growth of community opportunities for people under PSRB, Psychiatric Security Review Board jurisdiction. So we've been able to discharge, release, it's called conditional release of patients to the community as a result. So. The civil population has also been relatively flat, although this slide shows actually this is the census, not the capacity, of a slight reduction, 32 beds over a 5-year period.
Senator Winters, would you
talk a little about the work with PSRB and the changes that was made, because not everyone on this panel actually know the changes that was made in order to actually do a much better collaborating on behalf of the patient in order to get them back into the community, and when that occurred and how well that's working.
Senator Steiner Hayward, represent Senator Winters and members of the committee. Sure. 4 years ago, possibly, or
maybe a little more than that, four or five,
Senate Bill 420 was passed that created the two-tier system. It separated the Measure 11 patients from the non-Measure 11. It created a parallel panel, the State Hospital Review Panel, then began to take responsibility for the non-Measure 11 patients while they're in the hospital. So it decreased the number of patients that the PSRB had to be responsible for in the hospital, while simultaneously more community secure residential facilities and other less restrictive opportunities were growing in the community for release of people from the hospital. So what happened there is actually, for many years, there were guilty except for insanity patients in the state hospital who were ready for release from the hospital, who did not require the intensity of services we provide, but they didn't have an the opportunity for them to move into the community was not there. So investments were made in the community system. Those patients were able to leave the hospital, and we've had, as I said, as a result, 100 fewer GEI patients in the state hospital.
I requested that because it's another place where change was required, and another place where, and we all are protective of our professionalisms and how we've done things in the past, and we don't want to change. This was a sea change for PSRB in putting together, if I, you know, when we had the discussion on the policy of implementing the statute, it was very charged.
Senator Winters, so, you are correct. I would say there were some doubters 4 or 5 years ago, but the fact is that we could find the numbers for people released to the community from the state hospital, very low recidivism rate, people being revoked back to the state hospital is a very low number, so it's really been a successful initiative throughout.
Ms. Ames?
Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee, the Psych Security Review Board will be here on Monday with their presentation. We tried to schedule them close together because there is a lot of interaction and overlap.
Mm-hmm. Representative Hayden, do you have a question?
Thank you. Yes. Thank you, Chair Steiner Haywood. I have a question regarding the CCBHC, which is a Certified Community Behavioral Health Clinic Demonstration Program, that Oregon was one of 8 states that made it through the process, which increases the reimbursement from the federal government by about 10%, identifies about 14 clinics somewhat spread out throughout the state, which I'm very encouraged by. I'm glad that OHA went through the process to get that application, get that approved, stick with it, which will help build, I think, will help build our capacity that you're talking about at the community level. But from your perspective in a state hospital, is that program going to be enough, or is there another program coming online to support community-based to match up with the proposed closure of Junction City at the end of July 2018?
Senator Hayward and Representative Hayden, members of the committee, that's a great question. I'll be telling you in a few minutes about how we have just been successful certifying 450 additional beds under CMS standards at the state hospital, which raises our number to over 500, 550, 560 or so. So we will now be able to draw down, retroactive to last July 1st, we can draw down Medicaid and Medicare dollars in federal reimbursement for the state hospital, which takes a significant burden off the general fund of the state. And therefore, then the question is about reinvestment in community housing and programs for people.
Sure.
Thank you. And just when you say we, does that drawdown include Junction City, or is that only?
Okay. It does. Yes. Okay. Civil population, we were saying that's a flat number. Aid and assist population, I feel like I can't stress this enough. I know we've been talking about this for several years. This population continues to grow. This graph ends at December 2016, and it's slightly down since, actually it's a little below 200 today, but that is still an unanticipated significant increase in this population. There are some legislative concepts, bills that have been introduced that will be discussed in the legislature for some changes in that statute.
Superintendent, again, for the benefit of folks who are new to this committee, could you talk a little bit about your perspective on why that population has gone up so much? I'm not holding you to it, but I think it would be helpful for the committee to understand the dynamics here.
Senator Steiner-Hayward, I'm happy to do that, especially a month away from my retirement. I can be pretty honest, or at least express my opinion. When we look at that population, again, these are people who get arrested who are unable to assist their attorney to mount a defense. 45% of the people who come to the state hospital under that statute are arrested for misdemeanors, littering, public urination, theft. We recently had someone took something out of a cooler in the back of someone's truck. And as you see, this has grown over time. The issue is, and we have to continually focus on the availability of community mental health services, because I think that's what's happening. These are people who are mentally ill. They're in their community. They're obviously in distress. They obviously need help. They need treatment. But they're not committable. They're not dangerous. It's not dangerous to publicly urinate. It's not dangerous to litter or to steal a candy bar at the 7-Eleven or to call 911 repeatedly. And right now, the only way that people see, the only way to get these people into the treatment that they so obviously require is to arrest them. And then they go to jail quick, and then a judge signs an order, and within 7 days you're admitted to the state hospital. But it's actually, I think, the society's answer to the fact mentally ill people who need help won't necessarily agree to take it voluntarily in the community, and therefore they're arrested and sent to the state hospital.
So if we had appropriate facilities in the communities where people could be placed in diversion, with mental health courts and stuff, then those would be more appropriate, potentially, settings for them than at the state hospital.
Well, I believe so, and you also have to deal with the fact that the people will not agree voluntarily to the treatment.
Right.
So mental health courts, in my opinion, would have to enter into the equation along the lines of required mandatory community treatment for people who otherwise would want to refuse it.
I'm reminded of a conversation I had with Judge Waller from Multnomah County, mm-hmm. who talked about community court in East County, where there was a man who'd been there 100 times in the past 365 days, all for public urination or littering because of his alcoholism, and couldn't get into treatment because of a 30-year-old sex offense. And he wanted treatment. Here's somebody who wanted treatment. It just boggles the mind.
Yeah, and there are some models across the country. This is a national problem, criminalization of the mentally ill, it's referred to. Florida, there's a judge in Florida who has done some interesting things in Dade County. New York State has passed some statutes that Judge Waller, I know, is looking at. And Judge Jones up in Multnomah County has recently taken all of these cases into his court so that we can begin to understand the nature of the problem better.
Yes, Senator.
Can, and we can bring it back later, because this is two things. Not only do we need to work on this particular issue, but there's a real cost differential between, state hospital versus if we actually had the residential community facilities, even including the court costs. And I would hope that somebody does an analysis of that would actually point to the differential in cost. It's a lot less costly to do this in the communities than it is to have the individuals go to the state hospital.
Senator Winchett, absolutely correct. 2 years ago, I used the figure $750 a day for the treatment of an aid and assist patient in the hospital. Their average length of stay in the hospital is 75 days. If you multiply that out, we're spending a lot of money for someone who is littering or publicly urinating, only to return them to the community without a robust treatment plan for aftercare.
I would hope that, you know, all of the various stakeholders would begin to work on collectively on this issue, because it's going to take law enforcement, the courts, the CCOs, and the entire community to address this particular issue. It's not just one piece of saying specialty courts, or in this case, mental health courts. But it does, because unless we get busy with this, I only see the cost going up rather than coming down. And so, and the individuals are still not getting the treatment or what they really need.
Absolutely correct. So the next graph actually just combines the four previous graphs. So you see the top line is the overall population, and the lines underneath are the specific groups, guilty except for insanity, aid and assist, and civil. So. Right. Now John gets to speak.
Thanks, Greg. Again, good morning. John Swanson. The section on our budget provides a pretty high-level flyover, if you will, of the Oregon State budget. But there are some things of note that I want to point out on the first slide here. Shows a combined composite total of our budget for 17-19 for all three campuses, Salem, Junction City, and Pendleton. Total of $535.9 million for two-year budget. And as you've noted, every session, the largest portion of that is that blue part of the graph, and that is funding through state general fund, 435.8 or 81% of the budget, historically been the case. However, I would want to point out that we have moved the bar, or we'll be moving the bar a little bit on the non-blue section of the graph with what Greg had mentioned earlier. Leveraging the improvements that the hospital has made over the years and a very successful Joint Commission survey in 2015, we've been working hard on being able to find other revenue sources for cost of care through Medicare, principally, soon maybe third-party insurances as well. So when you look at the other funds, most of that on the other fund side is Medicare. It's odd that it says other funds, but those dollars are considered an insurance payment and considered other funds. About $58 million of that $65.6 million is from Medicare, which is about $40 million greater than what we had this biennium. We also have some private party insurance patient pay. We are required to bill for cost of care for our patients and attempt to collect based on an ability to pay. And then we have some other revenue sources that at the hospital for some bench work in our Boca Rehab part of our hospital. Our patients manufacture Adirondack furniture and do some piecework for local manufacturers and generate some additional revenues there. I would point out that the current budget, 2015-17, the other funds is only $23.3 million for this biennium. On the federal fund side.
Excuse me.
Yes.
Senator Gelson. So I just, thank you, Madam Chair. Something that hasn't come up before that I just learned this week that I thought was important to share around the Adirondack chairs. So you're operating a 14C sheltered workshop in the state hospital where people are earning less than minimum wage. Is that accurate?
Senator Gelser, we have a sheltered workshop, but the Adirondack chair project, the patients are paid minimum wage or more for that. So within our, we have multiple parts in our vocational program in that area, and the Adirondack Chair project is not, they're not earning less than minimum wage. Okay.
Then I want to find out how to buy one. And follow up?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Can you get for us the range of wages that are paid, including the low end to the high end that is less than minimum wage for the work that individuals are doing at the state hospital?
Yes, Co-Chair Steiner Hayworth and Rayfield, Senator Gessler, we'll get that for you.
Thank you.
As far as federal funds, the vast majority of those dollars are what's called disproportionate share hospital, which is part of the Medicaid program, a match federal state program. that is intended to defray some of the costs of charity care for hospitals. Mostly acute care hospitals in the state also receive DSH. About 25.5 million of the 34.9. We do get some Medicaid funding, but it's very limited due to what's called the Institution for Mental Disease Exclusion from the 1980s, which basically prohibits use of Medicaid funding for patients, I believe, under the age of 22 and over the age of 64, other than those individuals. So between those two ages, we're not eligible to draw Medicaid.
Can I just clarify that? It has, in part at least, to do with the size of the facility. So for facilities 16 beds and under, you can use Medicaid funds for those.
Correct.
But for the large size of the state hospital, you can't. And it's something that we're hoping the federal government will see fit to change, because there are a lot of good reasons for them to change it. But it's a major barrier towards establishing the kinds of facilities we want to establish for mental health patients around the state. Senator.
Although I think it's a subject for debate. I mean, some would argue that match helps us move towards more integrated settings, but I think that that's a
point
policy
well
decision
taken,
that's been made by CMS to move us away from institutionalization to more community-based, smaller support. So I would hope they wouldn't change it.
Point taken, but there are also some options for, I mean, some other kinds of facilities where this may be, not just the state hospital, where it may be useful. So anyway.
Co-Chair Steiner Hayward, that's true in this budget, and Pendleton College is able to draw more Medicaid than we can, pretty much. So, I would point out, as a result of being able to grow some of those non-general fund sources, that while the budget for this year is $435.8 million in general funds for 2017-19, the current biennium is $451 million. 86% of the budget, so we've reduced 86 down to 81, and optimistic that we are on the right path. The next slides break into each of the campus categories of the budget and really look at the composition of the expenditures. And as you'll note, again, the blue part of the graph has historically been the largest portion, and that is that we spend most of our funds on personnel, salaries, taxes, and benefits comprise almost 15% of our 85% of our budget, and then service and supplies, non-payroll items, comprise only 15%. And you'll see in a minute, most of those service and supplies are needed for direct care of our patients as well.
John, I'm going to ask you my favorite question. How's our workers' comp trend lines doing? Costs going down, and we're having less injuries of both patient and staff?
Senator Winter, Co-Chair Steiner Hayward, and been ignoring Co-Chair Rayfield and Senator Winters and members of the committee. Interesting, we look at this data all the time. The number of incidents, we particularly look at safe claims related to injuries to staff based on patient aggression. The numbers are down. They fluctuate. If you look year to year, the numbers have been decreasing each year for several years. But the costs are going up. So we're looking into that. Part of the phenomenon there, a person may have been injured 3-4 years ago, but they're still receiving treatment for that injury. So, for example, someone with a back injury may have been sent for physical therapy and didn't make any progress. Now they've had surgery and things like that. So we're digging into that data. But numbers of incidents are down, but costs have gone up.
Is the severity going down as well, follow-up?
That's what we're, it's exactly what we're trying to study. Although I would say just knowing about specific incidents that occur at the hospital, it seems to me that the number of assaultive incidents with patients injuring staff has gone down, as has the severity. So we're looking to see why the trend line for cost has increased. Yes, the numbers are down, degree of injury is down, but cost is up. And we think, our hypothesis is that it's the long-term issue, that some people who were injured some years ago are still...
You had some cases that were pretty severe, if I recall.
Few and far between these days, but any are unacceptable. We know that.
So, from new members of the committee, I would point out this is a major change, and this is my sixth year on this committee. And this is something we've been discussing
for a long time, and it's really, you guys have made some substantial progress in that arena, and it's really, you're to be commended for that.
Thank you. I'll give you a preface to a slide that'll be coming up later. Once we settled the crisis at the state hospital, we focused, and we talked about this 2 years ago, I remember at this committee, on the training that we provide our staff. And we've heavily invested in training, especially in something called collaborative problem solving, that we think has made a tremendous difference in the interaction between the direct care staff and the patients, less argumentative, less confrontational, more focused again on problem solving. And that has made, we have trained over 1,500 of our staff in that methodology, and it has made, it's just made a very significant difference. Our seclusion and restraint rates are down, injuries are down, lost work days are down, and things like that. And I attribute that mostly to the training that we provided.
Follow up on that, we also provided funds to DA Beglaw here for those that you have on the forensic side, that we call them frequent flyers, that actually individuals that probably were better served if they were in DOC rather in your facility. Is that still ongoing and working well?
Senator Winters, yes, we've looked at the patients. Again, what's always true is that those type of incidents are caused by a very, very small percentage
population
of our patients. And some of those patients, in fact, have, because of their jurisdiction, they're sent to, some patients are, have what's called dual jurisdiction. So they're under the PSRB as well as the Department of Corrections. And when we are able to testify to the PSRB that the person does not need the type of services we're providing, then they do go over to the Department of Corrections. But frankly, some have improved their condition so much that they now live in the community. So they've been conditionally discharged.
Great.
So.
Mr. Swanson.
The following slides are similar layout as far as the, again, in each case, the campuses are largely personal services. In Junction City, 87.6% of the budget's that, 89.6% in Pendleton College. And then on slide 30, the point that we want to make there is, as I mentioned earlier, on the non-payroll portion of our budget, a total of about $81.3 million for all three campuses, representing 15% of the total budget. Out of that 15%, 85% of those costs are considered direct care for such things as contracted professional services, outside medical costs if we are required or need to take our patients to Salem Health, for instance, pharmaceuticals, medication, durable medical equipment, food and kitchen, all required to care for the patients, which point here is in the past when there's been across the board cuts to non-payroll budgets in the state, it's very challenging for us to do that and continue to care for our patients. We only have really what I would say 15% or so of our budget that would be discretionary that we could potentially make some reductions in. Again, very high level look at our budget. Any questions on that part? Move to the next part. This next part talks about our policy option package, and some it actually combines with some of the fiscal improvements to alongside with the improvements, the rest of the improvements that we've seen at the hospital I mentioned earlier. And we're very pleased to report that as of July 2016, we now have all hospital level of care beds at the Oregon State Hospital eligible for Medicare and Medicaid if it were eligible. Reimbursement. Previously, we only had 115 beds that we were able to bill for. Again, that is largely because of the improvements that have been made at the hospital and the very positive Joint Commission survey in 2015 and work that we have embarked on in order to be able to have the facilities and the infrastructure in place to bill for those dollars. All coming together in July, we're excited to report that we are actually starting to bill for those beds as well.
Last July.
Last July.
So. Representative Bueller.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. So how much revenue are you projecting that will bring in per biennium, additional revenue?
Approximately $40 million.
There's a slide coming up that shows the future projections for future biennium.
That hopefully will be improving over time. That is principally just additional Medicare dollars, and there's potential for some additional third-party insurance, and then depending on what happens with Medicaid, potentially some there. But we haven't really had experience with it, so we've kept it fairly conservative into the future as far as we can.
So why wasn't that done in the past?
Co-chairs and Representative Bueller, principally because we weren't in a place to qualify for it. I don't think where we were with the hospital before Greg arrived and for the years, he was bringing us up to the level of certification and standard that we need to meet to be able to do that, we would have been in significant risk if we would have been billing for those services. I think
Representative Bueller, the hospital prior to 2010 had 5 units that were certified, even in the old Salem campus. The hospital had a survey by CMS, I think around 2009 or 10, it was before my time, and they found serious non-compliance with their standards, and so the hospital actually decertified 4 of the 5. So when I arrived in 2010, there was only 1 unit certified. It has to do with life safety issues, the environment in the old hospital, building the new hospital, and then improving the services the patients are receiving. Put us in a position when we had our 2015 Joint Commission survey, that's when we knew we would be able to pass a CMS survey. Their standards are a bit stricter than the Joint Commission. And so we began the process then. And there are arguments about whether guilty except for insanity and 370 patients qualify, that we have to prove that they do not meet the federal definition of inmate because inmates do not qualify. And it was just a pretty laborious process to get the additional beds filled. And finally, it wasn't until November of 2016 that finally CMS said they would certify the additional beds retroactive to July 1st, because you can only activate more additional certified beds at the beginning of a cost report year, as they call it. So we could go back to 2015.
That's really impressive work.
Yeah.
Representative Hayden.
Thank you, Co-Chair. As you look at, I think it's great, fantastic work, but as you look at it from a return on investment, the cost that the state has to put in to get those certifications, which we should do regardless of return on investment, but is that $40 million kind of a wash to keep up at that it costs more to do that, which I assume it is? Do we have any idea?
Representative, it's the slide that's coming up in about one or two.
Okay, I'll quit asking questions.
You're correct. There's a cost of doing business. So and to I'm be just, able to get that money, you have to spend some money.
And folks, I'm going to remind you that it's 9:25, and we've got about half an hour, a little bit more, and
that's
still
great.
About a third of the presentation to go. So
I'll move ahead.
Talk about the pot.
Yeah, so we'll go into the policy option package on the next page,
which
we'll get to these issues. Again, the policy package seeks to increase non-general funds by about $40 million. That is in principally Medicare payments. And I'm going to flip to the next slide while I'm talking about this. This is, there are some startup costs involved with this. And of course, I think you were referring to the cost for all the improvements to get to where we are. That's not really taking these into account. I've not done that analysis, but I think we were mandated to make a lot of those improvements whether we did this or not. So necessarily designed for that. But the idea here is that this is the beginning, that we will continue to build on this, and out 3 bienniums, we're conservatively projecting about $72.4 million additional dollars, new dollars, and over the course of the next 3 bienniums, about $160 million non-general fund dollars to run the hospital as a result of this. But in order to do this, we also have to make sure that we are properly documenting patient care, that we are accurately reporting and billing for the third party, which required us to make significant investments in our infrastructure, professionalism, and understanding of our staff and our billing systems. We had to significantly expand what's our utilization management part of our hospital to assure that we are meeting requirements for the level of care that we're providing in order for the federal government to reimburse them. make sure that we raise the bar on our treatment care notes and documentation of progress notes so that the federal government can see that we are actively treating our patients to, in order for them to participate in the cost of that. There's, as Greg mentioned, a significant standards that we need to meet in fire life safety and quality. And so we are proposing in this that we use a portion of these additional dollars to make some investments in those areas. We did this policy package in the late spring of 2015 and put our best estimate of what we would think we would need to do that. Since that time, we've actually been able to do some of this with existing resources, so we're looking at those investment costs again to see if we can pare those back and provide more of the non-general fund for the hospital by reducing those costs. There will be some, I want to make a point that the Junction City closure was not reflected in adjusting this POP. So there's about $5 million of these new dollars that would have come from that second year of Junction City operating. So we're not going to be providing services. We won't be able to bill for those services. So this needs to be adjusted for that closure as well to take those funds out of the budget.
Wait, let me clarify that, please, because those Junction City patients aren't just going to be released into thin air, right? They're going to, some of them will probably transfer back, right?
Correct.
To the state hospital. And so in that case, you will be billing for them, right? Or will it only be certain populations? I mean, it's not that we're not going to need to take care of those patients. We're just not going to be taking care of them at Junction City.
Co-Chair Steiner Hayward, that's correct, although we are limited to 569 beds that we can bill for, and they're all full or principally all full. So whether they're full of those patients or existing patients, we can only bill it for those levels.
And jumping ahead a little bit, but this will save us time later. I know the controversy about the recommendation to close Junction City, the logic of that, and again, as I assume from where I sit, you know, it sounds like I have conversations with the governor about it. But the state of Oregon has entered into an agreement with the Federal Department of Justice to expand the community mental health system in Oregon very significantly with more supported housing, teams of assertive community treatment, mobile crisis services, peer delivered services, etc. So if we were to assume that those services will come into existence, we should see a decreased reliance on state hospital beds. We'll see fewer admissions to the state hospital. We'll see more discharges from the state hospital, and we'll see people with shorter lengths of stay. So the balance there is always, there's an inverse relationship. So the less robust your community system is, the more state hospital beds you need. The more robust your community system is, the fewer beds. So the calculation is that the 75 or 80 beds that are filled in Junction City would be unnecessary if we invest in the community as described in the agreement with the Federal Department of Justice.
Thank you.
So it wouldn't be thin air, is my point. So
thanks. Just thought it was important to clarify.
Correct.
All that. Yeah. Thanks.
So again, slide 33 indicates what we would project into the future biennium for this policy option package and provides a significant return on the investment that we're proposing to improve the areas that we need to ensure that we're accurately billing and can continue to bill for services. Any questions on that portion?
Okay, back to me, and I'll go very quickly. These next two slides just provide some detail how we provide services in the state hospital, disciplinary teams, treatment malls. I know several members of the committee have been to the hospital and seen these in operations. Then slide 37, also we can go quickly past that. We've talked a lot about this, although let me mention that the as John pointed out, a high percentage of the budget of the state hospital is spent on staffing. There have been some significant things that have happened there. The growth in the 370 population has had the effect that people who come to us from jails, having been arrested, these aid and assist patients, are often very unstable, very acute, their behavior is problematic. And Senator Winter's comment earlier, the injuries, the assaults that take place that are principally among that population, because it takes us a bit of time to get to have those people stabilized more so.
For one second, yeah. Representative Alonso León.
Yes. Mm-hmm. I know you don't talk about demographics here and the people that you serve at the state hospital, but I'm really curious, and also curious to know what kind of, if you have culturally specific trained professionals who work with the different demographics that you serve. Just curious about that and the type of family education you may provide, considering segments of our population always don't know about mental illness, and so there's a, you know, education perspective. Do you offer all of that?
We do, Representative Alonso de Leon. We do. I would not claim that it's sufficient. We have the data on the racial, the ethnic groups of our patients. We have a very robust Native American services program, we'll say that, but I think we can do a better job in some of the other areas, although we do cultural competency training. We do have some staff who are involved in that. We have a lot of money spent on interpretive services for families as well as patients, but I'm not going to claim that we can't do a better job there.
Thank you.
Senator Winters.
Thank you. It might be well, and you can do it, provide the information, or to provide the panel with the demographics mm-hmm. of the ethnic makeup inside. You will probably be surprised that there's few that are of the brown color.
Mm-hmm. Color.
So I mentioned the staffing only because we're going to talk about overtime in 2 seconds. When you have that level of acuity, especially for the first few weeks of hospitalization of so many patients coming into the state hospital, they're often placed on one-to-one, sometimes two-to-one supervision, or they end up in restraints, or they end up in seclusion, which is the same as a one-to-one supervision. So there's an acuity factor that enters into our staffing needs and our overtime. Use. And then since the last session, Senate Bill 469 was passed. This has to do with the elimination of mandatory overtime, the creation of nursing staffing committees that define the numbers of staff per unit per shift, have influenced our staffing. So the next slide, this is average nursing overtime hours. To level the playing field, we do this on a per patient basis. So overtime hours that we work per patient is a downward trend, and especially in the past year, we've significantly increased the size of what we call our float pool, people who are, they'll fill in as necessary for one-to-one, two-to-one supervision, or to replace someone who is on vacation or called out sick. We currently spend about 22,000 hours a month on overtime in both campuses, Salem and Junction City combined. And when we break that down by number of units, by number of days in a month, and shifts, that basically comes to one person working overtime on each unit, each shift, every day. So, and it, that's a reduction from past experiences.
One of the challenges that you're having is actually in recruiting nurses? Is that a challenge?
Senator Winters, RNs right now, we are noticeably short of nurses. We're spending most of our nurse overtime or agency use, as we'll have that slide in a minute, on RNs on the 3 to 11 shift. Our day shift, night shift, and weekend shifts are actually pretty good right now, but we are short on the swing shift. We've recently taken a look at our recruitment efforts. We are establishing a nurse recruiter position for the hospital, and we have our HR staff now out at nursing schools looking to recruit graduates who are soon to come along. But yes, you're correct. Right now, there is a problem with RNs. We're looking to hire many more LPNs as well. The mental health technician category is very filled. We're good there. But RNs are difficult to recruit right now. So.
Thank you.
Okay. One thing, you don't have the slide, but just so you know, that the implementation of Senate Bill 469, which is basically about the elimination of mandatory overtime, which was a major problem at the hospital a few years ago, has nearly eliminated mandatory overtime. As I said, we've hired a lot of float pool staff in there, and we're using agency more frequently, which is the next slide. So you can see over a period of time between 2012 and 2016, May 2016, this was a significant downward trend, and this is actually directly related to Senator Winter's question. Since we cannot, we're not permitted under law now to mandate someone to work overtime, and until we fill our vacant positions, we rely on agency staff to fill the gap. So that's when you see the line suddenly increase.
Superintendent, have you seen a decrease in attrition rates with these changes? Because one of the concerns was that staff were burning out faster, and that, you know, they may have been working the hours and you didn't have to hire agency, but then they were quitting. What's your sense?
Senator Stein and Hayward, members of the committee, we that's some of the data metrics we collect all the time. It's been pretty flat, what I need the HR department to do is separate the data out for retirement, because that's in the attrition rate. So if people voluntarily retire, it's a different thing than if someone's burned out and left. But the overall rate has been flat for...
I'd be curious. Thank you.
We can get that data.
Thank you. So. Representative Malmstrom.
Thank you, Chair. As a registered nurse myself, the situation with the agency nurses worries me, because I know that a regular ongoing staff nurse is not the same as an agency nurse. They don't have the same buy-in. They don't have the same level of knowledge about things. And to me, I'd like to see a plan to reduce that number. And when you do have to use agency nurses, is there any consistency in which agencies you're using? Are these people that have worked there before, or what's the situation there? Because the care is just not equivalent.
Right. Representative Malmstrom, yes, I think only two agencies that we rely on, and many of the nurses who work as agency nurses for us are regular employees, so they work frequently at the hospital. They go through our orientation and training before they're allowed to work on the floor. And some of them are actually nearly full-time people. They'll fill in 3-4 times a week. And we always try to convince them to become our full-time staff. They choose not to, usually for their own personal reasons. They can then make their own schedule and be off when they want to be off and work when they want to work. But there's I wouldn't say consistency is an issue there.
And as Greg mentioned, we've increased this principally in two agencies, and many of those have come from travel nurse appointments, which at least gets us consistency for a longer period of time with the same individual.
Thank you.
So then the last two slides, one is where are we going? The point here is, you know, we're very proud of the progress the hospital has made in the last 6-7 years. And we can say honestly that we believe we are now the best performing state hospital in the country. But that's improvement in a relative sense. So we're a lot better than we used to be. We're a lot better than most state hospitals in this country. But objectively speaking, we have many improvements still to make. And it's the last bullet on this page, the Malcolm Baldrige Award. The Joint Commission encouraged us to apply for the Baldrige Award. We're in the process of doing that. It's a multi-year process. But the criteria for the Baldrige Award actually create the objective measurements that we're looking for in terms of what does a great hospital really look like? How does it operate? How does it serve its customers? How does it listen to people that we serve? And then some other criteria as well. So we're as happy as we are with the improvements in the hospital. We know that we have more to do.
Senator Gelser.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to thank you for, one, the work that you've done to really transform the hospital. I think 10 years ago, it really would have been impossible to imagine being at the place that we are at today. And your leadership has taken it from just being a building and a building change. You could have the most beautiful building in the world, and without a culture change and a sense of urgency and a mission that's focused on the patients that are there, you can't have the success that you found. But I think one of the things that reflects what's driven that success is what you just said. We've come so far, you know, compared to others, we're still great, but there's still so much more to go. And I appreciate that transparency and that focus that you always have of what's that next thing that we can do to be better. And I don't know that there's a way to thank you enough for the leadership that you've offered to make a change that I, frankly, a decade ago thought wasn't possible. So thank you.
Thank you. I have to have 1 minute to say something about that before I leave the microphone here.
So, yes.
Yeah. So where are we going? We're going to continue to decrease our reliance on general fund. We want to continue to provide comprehensive staff training, and that's about competency. We want to expand our use of collaborative problem solving, which is having such a great effect on incidents and seclusion restraint. We want to increase our peer-delivered services. We have 6 or 7 peers, peer recovery specialists who work at the state hospital. We'd like to double that number, frankly, to do a better job there. We're focusing already on trauma-informed approaches. We've done a significant job already of reducing the civil wait list. It used to be 30 or 40 people waiting 60, 70 days to be admitted. The civil wait list these days is 10 or 12 people, and they're usually admitted within 2 weeks of going on the list. We want to address that aid and assist population, especially for misdemeanors, reduce the length of stay for patients who are civilly committed, discharge people more rapidly once they're identified as ready to place, most of which is outlined in the last page, which is the detail relevant to the state hospital in the U.S. Department of Justice agreement. That we're looking to discharge 90% of our civilly committed people within 120 days of admission, unless they continue to require hospital level of care, and to discharge people. The metric for this year is 75% of people within 30 days of being declared ready to leave. We're around 60-65% right now, so we have some work to do there. And next year, the year 2 of the agreement, it becomes harder, 85% of people within 25 days. And year 3, June 30th, 19, 90% of people should be leaving the hospital within 20 days of being declared ready to leave, which is a significant change, but it depends on community
investment.
That's the key. Yeah.
Senator Mayor.
And that's a good ending. It depends upon community investment, because I share the sentiments of Senator Geltzer that institutionalization, the same discussion that we had, and I won't talk about how many years and years ago, with the closure of Fairview, and that whole looking at the integration back into our society, and without the community system in place. So I'm hoping you're going to stay around enough to help us now with that next phase, which is the all the residential community needs that are there. And that we actually do the job of educating our various communities across the state on mental illness. I think we still have the stigmata there that we need, where individuals, don't have this fear factor, and also that we get rid of that not in my neighborhood.
Thank you.
So 1 minute. Before I leave, in any chance, Linda says this may be the last time I get to appear in front of you. I want to say thank you to all of you for this is the cherry on top of my 44-year career. I've been a superintendent. I've worked in this field for 44 years. I've been a superintendent for somewhere between 25 and 30. I worked in 7 different state hospitals, mostly in New Jersey, and this was just the best ending a person could hope for. You approved the resources. You approved the construction of the new hospital. It created the opportunity to do great work. And you're correct. A new building in and of itself doesn't do a lot. You can run a bad hospital in a new building, but we were committed to do something different. And I have always felt fully supported by the legislature. I'm so happy many of you have come out repeatedly for tours of the hospital. We love to show off a bit. We love it when other states come and see us and reinforce what we believe we know about ourselves. I will be staying in Oregon for quite a while, and I will be around to help mentor and coach the next superintendent. We want to make sure we don't slide back here, and then other projects as well in the community. So you'll see me somewhere around, and sure, if you need lean methodology coaching, the legislature, I'm happy to do it. But more than anything, I want to say thank you.
Thank you.
I think it's almost impossible for us to thank you enough, Superintendent. As Senator Gelser said 10 years ago, the idea, I wasn't in the legislature, but I was on the medical side then, mm-hmm. and you guys were, and it was a place of horror stories, and that's not the case anymore. And that is a remarkable transformation, and you are the kind of person who will give credit to all the people who've on the front lines, but you put them there, and you empower them to do it. And good leaders do that. They choose the right people, and they give them the authority to do what they need to do, and don't micromanage them. And that's really, right. really impressive.
Right.
So this committee and the entire state can't thank you enough for your service.
Well, thank you.
Piece of cake. Yes, thank you very much, Senator Steiner Harewood and Co-Chair Rehfeld, who's not here, and the committee. We couldn't let this moment go.
Just introduce yourself for the record.
I'm sorry. I'm Mark Fairbanks. I'm the Chief Financial Officer, the Chief Operating Officer for the Oregon Health Authority, and proud colleague of Superintendent Roberts. So a lot has been said. You just said a lot, and others have. And on behalf of the agency, and I speak for the agency, for the Director Saxton, and for my colleagues on the leadership team, and all of my colleagues at the agency, that Greg's tenure began in 2010. We all know him now as an accomplished fixer and a builder of state hospitals, mostly in the East and specifically in New Jersey. This explains a lot about Greg and how he interacts with the CFO. I won't go into a lot of those stories, but I wanted to share a little personal perspective with you, and I know that I do speak on behalf of my colleagues as well. You know, my 18 months here in this particular job, my first state experience, I'm kind of a non-state government, a commercial builder and fixer. And I've found that Greg has been, you know, an incredible colleague. He has provided the leadership that Senator Steiner Hayward and others have mentioned. He has a passion. He has a passion. He also has a keen sense for operational excellence. I want to call out that the model that has been built at the hospital demonstrates a lot of systemic thinking. It's having a major impact. It's working. This is hard work. It's hard to take something like the hospital, the state it was in, and move it to the state that it's in now, and then look forward to, the new house on the hill, and manage this workforce to do better and greater things. So the framework is in place. I, in my wheelhouse for the agency, adopted this model across the agency, and we are going to already are beginning to implement a lot of these disciplines in every aspect of the Oregon Health Authority, and I think we're going to see some great benefit, particularly with the challenges before us. So I would like to just kind of close out by saying that a couple things about Greg. You know, he's a demonstrative individual, hence the New Jersey reference. He's an assertive leader. He's challenged me many times, especially in the aforementioned budget presentation and position control issues. We've had a lot of fun working together in that area. Always pragmatic, no nonsense. Greg suffers no fools. He's clear. He's decisive. He has a huge heart, and I'll tell you, he's worthy of the trust and respect of a true friend. Thanks, Greg.
Thank you very much.
I don't want anyone to think that it's been easy and that this body has not put you through your paces. for all of the new ones and everyone's listening in, and for those individuals over these past 10 years and prior to the 10 years who worked on the changes, and one of my good colleagues who isn't here, who worked with me, was Senator Bates. Mm-hmm. And I need to say that because there's a lot of work that's been done from the nursing staff who came into this building to talk to myself and Senator Courtney and others and other staff and what have you. But, and the building blocks that go in to where we are today. And the investment. But certainly your leadership in making that culture change there and those transitions is very laudable. I'm serious when I say I hope you're going to stay around because the job isn't done.
Correct.
that there's still those of us who are very, very still committed, so that Oregon, where we're leading in at the hospital level, we too want to lead in the community level.
Absolutely.
So just need to put that out there on record for you, and don't take too long on your vacation time, be good, because just know you still have work to do.
Correct.
And since we're naming names, there's one other that needs to go out there. Representative Carolyn Tomei has deeply engaged in this work, and I know has been a partner with you, and she's not with us in the building anymore, but her work is extraordinary.
She probably is. Awesome. Any other business before the committee? If not, we're adjourned.
Thank you.
Thank you.